From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. These are the halcyon days for hackers.
Another day, another major hack attack.
We had Sony, we had Lockheed Martin, and we had Citigroup. Now we can add the United States Senate to the list of groups that's experienced a hack attack.
Another cyber attack today. That one took down the website of the Central Intelligence Agency. The CIA knocked down.
Hackers in the limelight? Well, there's Anonymous. No one knows whether Anonymous is an actual group or a loose affiliation of people. We do know that the group or whatever appears to like causes. It hacked the Church of Scientology, and last year it shut down PayPal, Visa, and MasterCard to protest those companies' refusal to process payments in support of WikiLeaks. Then there's Lulz Security, or LulzSec. The name comes from LOL, or Laugh Out Loud, and it's often described as a group of 1990s-style hackers, people doing it just for fun. LulzSec hacked the Senate website, the PBS website, and this week, as we heard, the CIA. Eric Corley is an old-school hacker, the owner and publisher of 2600, the Hacker Quarterly, who goes by his pen name, Emmanuel Goldstein. We asked him what was behind LulzSec's recent attacks.
Impatience with the progress that organizations have made insofar as protecting the computer systems and ultimately our privacy. If you'll notice in the case of Sony, 1 million usernames and passwords were leaked. Why was that information easy to get in the first place? Obviously, Sony is not taking necessary precautions. The incompetence insofar as protecting vulnerable information is simply staggering, and it needs to be exposed.
Fair enough, but sometimes there are real victims. I'm thinking of the Epsilon hack back in the spring. This is, I guess it's a direct marketing company that had all sorts of personal information from all sorts of major institutions, including financial institutions, and exposed email addresses and who knows what all in a major breach. Sony, there are millions of Sony users whose maybe credit card information and passwords were vulnerable. These are not victimless crimes, right?
What would you say if I told you that that information had already been obtained by some evil entity and they were using these credit cards and this personal information to steal identities and commit credit card fraud? And then you have a group come along and expose this and say, look, here it is. Here's 1 million user IDs and passwords. Look how easy that was to get. Which scenario is more likely to result in a change?
Law enforcement around the world is paying a lot of attention to hackers, and some people are being prosecuted under various criminal codes. Should they be?
It's inevitable that investigations will ensue based on all the things that have been happening. But I think in the end, when it comes down to what the penalty actually will be, you need to look at what the intent was. You need to look at what was learned and whether we're better off with this information than without this information. When I was prosecuted back in the 1980s, basically I was facing, they told me, 55 years in jail. But in the end, I wound up paying for the computer time that I used without authorization. And I gave a lecture to a room full of FBI agents on how to improve their security. And I think everybody walked away from that better off than they walked into it.
How much of this is just anti-authoritarianism, wanting to have something, have access to something because you're told that you can't?
It's impossible to say what the true motivating factor is for any one particular hacker. I mean, it could be anti-authoritarianism, it could be lack of a strong father figure, who knows? But I think ultimately there are certain basic values that we subscribe to, and that's that we don't cause damage, we don't commit any kind of fraud, and we share the information that we obtain with the rest of the hacker community, and we learn from it.
Do you think that the systems will ever be hack-proof? And then if they ever get there, will you and your community stand down?
If these organizations ever get to the point where they are successfully able to isolate sensitive information, and by sensitive information I mean anything that has private information about us, to keep that isolated from the rest of the internet, you'll simply see that this information does not get out there anymore. That will be the proof that it's secure. Like, for instance, not to toot our own horn, but the 2600 subscription list, all right, has never gotten out because we keep it isolated. You'd have to physically break in and figure out our encryption scheme and somehow get out without being detected and then spread that around. You can't simply log onto a machine and access the information because we're not that stupid. However, banks and credit agencies and phone companies and power companies and the like, they don't seem to care, and they leave this information lying around. And what's even worse than all of that, though, is how much information we willingly give out about ourselves on such social networking sites as Facebook without realizing the potential problems that having all this personal information out there might result in for us. So we really all need an education on how to keep our privacy private.
Emmanuel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Emmanuel Goldstein, or not Emmanuel Goldstein, is the publisher of 2600, The Hacker Quarterly. So hacking is on the rise, hacking that strikes at the very nerve centers that control our lives, the CIA, the IMF, the Senate, for crying out loud. Even our video game consoles are vulnerable. Everything about us is online, and everything online is in jeopardy. Or not. Security technologist Bruce Schneier says that hacking has always been with us. In fact, he compares the recent coverage of hacking to the perennial media frenzies over shark attacks. They're attention-grabbing, but not really worth the airtime expended. But it's fun and easy, he says, when groups like Lulzsec and Anonymous are only too willing to mug for the cameras.
I don't see these attacks being out of the ordinary or more numerous or even nastier. I mean, this is stuff we've been seeing for years and years. The criminals have always been stealing credit card numbers. I don't see it as an epidemic in anything but media attention to it.
Although at least one of the hacker groups, Lulzsec, has a request line for crying out loud. Listen to this.
Bonjour. You have reached the voicemail box of Pierre Dubois and François Deluxe. We are not available right now as we are busy raping your internet. Leave a message and we will get back to you whenever we feel like.
Isn't that worthy of media attention?
Oh, I think it is worthy of media attention, but I'm not sure it's anything new. I mean, honestly, there have always been hacker groups who chat online and do these fun things. This is actually what hacking was before the criminals discovered it. It was just kids playing politics and looking for bragging rights by hacking into commercial websites or government websites. So this Lulzsec group, and like the Anonymous group, it's now bubbling to the top of media attention, which unfortunately, because these guys want attention, they're doing more stuff.
Are you suggesting that these breaches happen all the time, putting my personal information at risk and I don't even know about it?
Oh, yeah, all the time, for years. I guarantee you have credit card numbers in your wallet right now, every one of your listeners does, that has been hacked. Maybe this month, maybe last year. This is what happens. Most criminal groups don't make a lot of noise. Most of the time, those attacks go unnoticed. The companies that experience them, usually they're forced to announce it. They do it as quietly as possible. You know, generally, these things aren't made a big deal of. But yes, this happens all the time, which should really let you know how little a risk this is. I mean, yes, there's a risk of credit card fraud, but when you see a hacking in the media, it doesn't mean the risk is greater. It just means this one, out of all the hundreds that happened, the media decided is worth paying attention to.
Now, we just got off the phone with Emmanuel Goldstein of 2600, the Hacker Quarterly, and he says that all of this activity, whether more prevalent or not, is all ultimately for the cause of good, for exposing security vulnerabilities, and I should be happy that this is going on. Should I be happy that this is going on?
Some of it, but not a lot of it, right? You know, when there's hacks from the Chinese, which might be government-sponsored, going into U.S. corporate and government sites, I don't see a lot of good that comes from that. When someone like Lulzsec breaks into a site because they can, a lot of security professionals look at that and said, we told you so. You know, we've been telling these companies for years and years that their security isn't very good. And they've been not listening. So here's a hacker group that actually is not just saying it, they're demonstrating it. And that, in the end, oddly enough, will make us safer. The vulnerability that hackers used to break into Citibank was embarrassingly stupid. It's kindergarten security they got wrong. Right? That shouldn't happen in 2011.
The culture of hacking is so anti-authoritarian, and they kind of get to decide for themselves what constitutes right and wrong. Are you concerned at all that LoveSec or some other group will create mischief that goes far beyond exposing security vulnerabilities into something, you know, far more malicious or at least dangerous?
Well, you know, the culture of online hacking is as varied as the culture of real crime. You've got groups like LulzSec, which are basically kids goofing off. There's actually real criminals, both lone criminals, organized crime, national, international, that are stealing identity information, credit card numbers, that are basically committing fraud. You also have national intelligence groups who are very quiet. They never want to make the news, but they are quietly penetrating networks, trying to get information, and potentially doing a lot of harm to national security. So it's really wrong to talk about sort of the one hacker culture. You know, out of all those groups, LulzSec is by far the most benign.
All right, Bruce. So if this is shark attack journalism, a sudden focus on something that actually goes on all the time, what should our coverage of computer hacking be?
You know, I think what's important to the broad trends in criminal hacking, domestic and international, where the money flows, how it works, looking at liabilities. There was a case just recently decided where a corporate customer of a bank lost hundreds of thousands of dollars to fraudsters, not because of what they did, because the banks lacked security. They sued the bank, and the bank successfully argued that they were not responsible. This is extraordinarily important. Trends in what the president and what the country does in cybersecurity policy are important to cover. And these things are being covered. It's not like, you know, we're ignoring them. But these, to me, are far more important than the particular hack that happened last week.
Bruce, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Author Bruce Schneier is Chief Technology Security Officer for British Telecom.
Coming up, a language shift in Libya, from protest to uprising to civil war.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Reputation.com, with tools designed to help doctors, lawyers, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When popular anger bubbled up in Libya last February, the media described it as a series of protests calling for the ouster of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi.
Demonstrators took to the streets of Benghazi on Wednesday.
The Western media's only got hold of footage of the protests through YouTube.
Protests in Libya are spreading across the country.
But as the conflict escalated, it no longer fit the protest model of the Arab Spring of Egypt and Tunisia, and the media's terminology shifted.
It is now early morning in Libya, and the uprising continues.
Libya's uprising is moving ever closer to Tripoli, but the situation is fluid.
But it seems this rebellion is now on Gaddafi's doorstep.
4 months later, uprising and rebellion are no longer terms of choice for the media. Yet again, the conflict has been redefined.
The more pictures emerge of the fighting, the more it looks like a civil war.
The Red Cross is calling it a full-scale civil war.
President Jacob Zuma of South Africa arrived to mediate in Libya's civil war.
This week, the Associated Press sent a memo out to reporters and editors informing them that the AP would now refer to the fighting in Libya as a civil war. Some other news agencies have already used the term, but the wide-ranging AP is a standard-bearer of language usage for many news outlets. It makes civil war official. Tom Kent is the AP's deputy managing editor and standards editor. He says the change was not taken lightly.
Originally, we decided not to use the term because we felt that the fighting was really a local rebellion, a local insurrection. It didn't have the characteristics of a civil war. And then after a while, we reviewed it again at the recommendation of our staff in the Mideast, and we pulled out everything we knew about poli-sci and decided that it really was a civil war by now.
What elements define the events in Libya as a civil war? What makes it different from an armed uprising?
Well, the National Transitional Council, which represents the rebels, controls about a third of the inhabitable part of the country at this point, and each side is really a coherent group with some military power of its own, and the fighting is basically over internal issues. and it's been going on for a long time. Neither side is the creation of foreign powers, although one side obviously is getting help. So you add that up, and it looks like a civil war to us.
Tom, some parties to the struggle say that this is a war between the whole population and one man with an army he maintains with mercenaries. Do you think that's true? And would that still meet the definition of civil war?
Gaddafi still has support. He still has a city that could be rising up against him but isn't. He still has a coherent military. That could change, and our own terminology is flexible, but at the moment it looks like a civil war.
Obviously, words are important, which is why you took so much time to consider these words. How do you think your decision will change people's perception of the conflict?
People can react to the fact that something is a civil war in many ways. They can decide it's a civil war, we shouldn't get involved. They could say it's a civil war and one side is perpetuating atrocities and we should get involved. We don't set out to change people's perception. We're describing what it is.
This week, 10 American congressmen filed a lawsuit against the president saying that he overstepped his authority by participating in the NATO operation in Libya. The White House, meanwhile, says the U.S. role in the conflict is limited and that we are not at war. The AP's use of civil war, which will be reflected in all of the news outlets that pick up the AP's articles and follow the AP's style, is going to have some bearing on foreign policy.
Well, I'd like to think that foreign policy will be decided on issues other than AP's terminology. There are civil wars worth intervening in and civil wars not worth intervening in. I just don't think that the term changes what the situation is as policymakers would see it. People will have to make their judgments about political and military action toward Libya based on the broad sense of what the conflict is rather than whether it's a civil war specifically or not.
Right. But as you said, among the various ways that people may respond to the word civil war, one response that is raised most often, it was raised by Politico, is that it would generally diminish the American appetite to intervene. If it's an internal struggle, it's not our business.
I don't know that that's so. In the 1990s, there was a civil war in the Balkans that the U.S. got involved in, and I think there was general feeling in the United States at the time that it was a good idea. So I don't think that calling something a civil war per se means that it's a hands-off situation.
There were many who objected to the transition from the word protester to the word rebel to describe participants in the uprising. There was some pushback, some negative reaction. Have you experienced any with your adoption of the phrase civil war?
At least within our organization, we haven't had any pushback. And a matter of fact, it's quite the opposite. In March, some AP reporters were calling it a civil war. And we thought that was going too far, so we pulled people back a little by saying it's not a civil war, at least yet. Let's not use that term. So when we finally said civil war is okay, I imagine a lot of people may have thought to themselves, well, finally.
So among the journalists, no pushback. What about from political operatives?
To my knowledge, we have not had any reaction. Someone who wrote about our decision asked the White House, and they had no comment, which is sort of how I feel. We describe the situation adequately and accurately. And I think the policy debate should go on other bases.
Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Tom Kent is the Deputy Managing Editor and Standards Editor at the Associated Press. Last week, the FCC released a report that at 360 pages is one of the most comprehensive overviews of the U.S. media ever produced. Titled The Information Needs of Communities, it's the culmination of 2 years of work, the product of 600 interviews and workshops held all over the country. One of the report's key findings is that while the media in general are rich and vigorous, local reporting has taken a palpable hit. Worst of all, neither old media nor new seem to have the resources to hold government accountable. Stephen Waldman headed the project. His findings suggest that journalism's crucial function as local watchdog has been muzzled, even as information blooms online. It was, he says, quite a surprise.
You have this incredible moment of abundance. There are more stories, there are more media outlets. So to have all that abundance and at the same time dig down and find out that we're actually experiencing really serious shortages of a certain type of reporting, which we call local accountability reporting, was a bit counterintuitive.
Okay, local accountability reporting means accounting for government's impact on localities. And you noted that 27 states have no reporters based in the nation's capital, and that newspapers are producing many fewer stories.
Right. Or another example is that during a five-year period, the amount that state governments spent went up by about 20%. And during that same time, the number of reporters covering state government went down by about a third. Anyone who has a concern about how tax dollars are spent on a state level, that's a bad formula. And it ripples through the system in a variety of ways. First of all, basic reporting functions like the covering of City Hall and the school board and the State House and health and education have gotten less and less. First, that means that reporters are relying more on press releases.
Which means the news gets driven by these government agencies and politicians and not by probing reporters.
Which was another surprise in a way, because one of the characteristics of the modern digital media era is it empowers people. So to find that at the same time that's happening, there's this countervailing trend, which basically is a shift of power from citizens to institutions, to government, to companies, because they're in a better position to drive the storyline. About 15,000 reporters left newsrooms. Most of that happened in the last 4 or 5 years. But there's this tremendous innovation going on the digital media side. So is it filling the gap?
You're talking about local and hyper-local sites that offer accountability reporting. The Voice of San Diego, the Texas Tribune, the Chicago News Cooperative are a few examples. So what are they doing that's working? And why don't you think more of those will spring up?
They're doing great investigative work. They're doing database journalism, really top-notch stuff. Channel 4 in San Diego, they had some cutbacks in staff. They no longer were doing as much depth, and the news director wanted to improve it. So he went to Voice of San Diego, which, as you said, is one of the hot new startups, and they worked out a deal where Voice of San Diego goes on the air a couple times a week, and they do San Diego Fact Check and San Diego Explained. It's a very viable model with one big if. The nonprofits have to have enough money, but that's a pretty big if.
Okay, so the American news media has an accountability gap. You offer some solutions in the report. Can you go quickly through them?
So first of all, in the nonprofit sector, individual citizens, philanthropists, foundations all need to be thinking about this as an important part of building a better community and a better country. We never really had any need to do that. It was kind of taken care of by the commercial media. Not true anymore. If you have a concern about health or education or something like that, you better make sure that there's an education reporter covering the schools.
Solution number one is rich people need to pony up.
Rich people do need to pony up, but the government needs to clean up the tax code, because right now there's all sorts of ambiguities and problems with the way IRS deals with nonprofit media. For instance, the IRS ruled against a newspaper that wanted to convert from being a commercial entity to being a nonprofit entity. That's really unfortunate, because that could be a great model. There are lots of newspapers that could survive. They just can't make 30% profit margins anymore.
What else?
Universal broadband. Having high-speed internet across the spectrum is a kind of prerequisite for innovation. Because if you're in a community where the newspaper has contracted and there's some good stuff going on online, but you're not online, you have taken a big step backwards in terms of the quality of the information.
Rich people, change in the tax code, universal broadband. Anything else?
The federal government currently spends about $1 billion a year on advertising. A lot of it goes to national entertainment programming. It could be Army recruiting, Census Bureau, safety. So we proposed, why not try to target some of that to local media?
You also suggest in your report that there be more transparency, that broadcasters post information about how they're doing. Who cares?
Well, there is actually currently a rule that says if you as a TV station take money from an advertiser and basically run advertorials, you have to disclose it. But not many people notice this disclosure. It goes by very quickly on air, and the wording is hard to figure out. So let's take just that simple idea and say, what if in addition to disclosing it on air, you disclose it on the internet, create a permanent searchable record so that anyone in the community can see which stations do pay for play the most? That's an example where transparency can actually have a transformative effect, much more so than if the government tried to itself make judgments about what was appropriate and what wasn't.
How likely do you think any of your recommendations are to be implemented?
Well, I think the transparency recommendations for the FCC have a good chance because the chairman of the FCC endorsed them after the report came out. The idea of having some ad money go into local communities instead of nationally, I think, will have a lot of support because local media will like it. And the tax code changes, I think actually some of that could be cleared up through with clarifications from the IRS without congressional action. And I want to clarify one thing. One way or another, if we want to have accountability reporting, citizens are going to have to pay for some of it. And that can't just be rich people. That has to be everyone.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Stephen Waldman is senior advisor to the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission and author of the FCC's report on the information needs of communities, which you can find at fcc.gov/info-needs-report.
FCC Commissioner Michael Copps thinks that the proposals in Waldman's report are too narrow. The recommendations are all well and good, he says, but the FCC, he believes, is still pulling its punches and not acting on the authority that it has. He says if it were up to him, the report would have been, quote, significantly different.
Some of the analysis would be different, and definitely the recommendations. And that's the key point here. We have a serious problem. We don't have serious solutions. There's too much of a tendency to look to others to solve this problem rather than to the commission itself. The big recommendation for the FCC presented by the Waldman report is more disclosure. Put information online. Why, if you put all this information online, should somebody spend all the time to plumb the internet and get all this information if there's no confidence that there's an FCC that's going to do anything about providing redress when complaints come in?
We here on the NPR airwaves are only too well acquainted. When government starts trying to facilitate content, it turns into a gigantic political problem.
Government should not be facilitating content. Government should be facilitating an environment where there is a vibrant civic dialogue. That was the whole purpose of the First Amendment to the Constitution written by the founders. And the founders went on understanding that their fledgling young country needed to have news and information if its far-flung citizens were going to make decisions intelligent for the future. So they built post roads and established postal subsidies for newspapers. They knew that democracy depended upon a vibrant information infrastructure. That was the theory behind allowing broadcasters free use of the public's spectrum in return for the quid pro quo of serving the public interest in providing news and information. That's as American as apple pie. What has been ahistorical about it is this: just let the market do it, everything will be fine. And as a result of that deregulatory philosophy and as a result of all the mega consolidation that we have gone through in recent years, we find newsrooms shuttered, investigative journalism on life support, and we can't just wait around in some hapless hope that the internet is somehow magically going to fix this, because there are many signs right now that the internet is headed down some of those same troublesome roads that did so much damage to traditional media. So I'm not saying that the FCC can fix everything. It should fix what it can fix. It should be active where it has jurisdiction.
Commissioner, you mentioned the quid pro quo, access to the public spectrum in exchange for a public service function. It seems to me that along about the 70s, when broadcasters realized that news operations could be profit centers, that any real sense of public service disappeared, and it all became about building audience and ratings and advertising revenue. Anywhere in this 400-some-page report, is there mention of reinvigorating the public interest obligation of broadcasters?
The commission has walked away from the public interest oversight. it was established to do and that it used to do to at least some extent. I'm not saying we did a marvelous job of implementing that, but there was some discipline. And I've heard everybody from Walter Cronkite to Ted Koppel to Dan Rather saying, you know, we didn't have that wonderful Edward R. Murrow generation of journalism just out of the generosity of the broadcasters' hearts. We had it because they knew the FCC was there. They knew they had made an agreement to do this, to do news and information. That was the price they paid. So there are things we can do. We haven't taken away a license on public interest grounds in 30 years. It's time to get serious. And I think if the FCC was serious, if it was in a position where it actually put a licensee on probation for a year or so until they cleaned up their act, I think the word would go forth pretty quickly, and I think it would have some very salutary effects on the quality and quantity of news and information produced for American viewers and listeners.
All right. Commissioner, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Michael Copps is Commissioner of the FCC.
Coming up, the Internet Echo Chamber, revisited, re-examined, and reconsidered.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help doctors, lawyers, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them on newsstands, iPhone and iPad, and at The Economist Online. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with another examination of the evolving media echo chamber. We all know the internet is a moving target, and so our concerns about it can yo-yo. The fact that we can now choose among myriad information streams allows us to cherry-pick our media diets so we encounter only news that reinforces our worldview. Back in 2004, University of Chicago professor Cass Sunstein, who now works for the Obama administration, said that we should be afraid, very afraid.
The greatest danger of the echo chambers is unjustified extremism. So it's a well-known fact that if you get a group of people who tend to think something, after they talk to each other, they end up thinking a more extreme version of what they thought before. And the danger of that is you can make a situation where people demonize those who disagree with them. And that's an ongoing threat to our democracy.
That gave me the willies until 2009, when I spoke to Lee Rainey of the Pew Internet and American Life Project. He conducted a study of people's behavior on the internet during the 2004 presidential campaign.
One of the surprising things we found in that survey was that those who are the most technologically adept and those who are the most engaged with information actually are not in the echo chamber pattern. They are actually seeking out and finding out more arguments opposed to their views than those who are less technologically adept and less interested in political information. The most technologically adept people are, you know, scanning every horizon they can, and they can't help but bump into stuff that doesn't agree with them.
So I stopped being afraid. Until last month, when I spoke to Eli Pariser, author of The Filter Bubble. He said that Google, which once ranked search results solely on popularity, now personalizes results according to our online clicking behavior. In fact, there's a whole industry based on gathering information so that websites and advertisers can serve us better.
One of the underlying dynamics here is that a lot of what this personalization trend is about is making the web a more passive experience, delivering information to you rather than you having to seek it out. Steve Jobs famously said, you have to have your brain on, you have to be leaning forward to use your computer. And that was sort of what was good about the internet. It was an interactive medium. What these companies are trying to do is make it easier and easier just to sit back and have the information passively come to you. And it would be sad if it went in that direction, because when you do get yourself on the hunt for information that's exciting and interesting and different, you learn a lot.
Can you give me an example from your own research of how the same search might yield different results for different people?
Earlier this year, I asked a number of friends to Google Obama, and see what came up. Sure enough, you know, one person got the top link from the New York Times about Obama. The other person got the top link from Fox News. And there did seem to be a partisan tilt in the information that they were getting based on apparently what they had been clicking on before. You know, neither of them were even aware that their search results differed from each other at all. I mean, you can't see how much your experience of the web is redirecting you toward things that you're going to find palatable or you're going to already agree with.
One thing that you mentioned to us is that as a founder of MoveOn, you wanted to cultivate online a number of Facebook friends who were clearly conservative. And you did. You friended conservatives, but slowly but surely, Facebook caused them to fade away.
One morning I logged on to Facebook and they just weren't there. Facebook was looking at who I was engaging with, what I was clicking on, watching everything I was doing on the site. And it was editing my newsfeed to edit them out. It was saying, you say that you're interested in these people, but actually, we know that, you know, you are interacting more with people who are like you. And so we're going to show you more of their stuff, and we're going to let these people fade away.
Eli Pariser, author of The Filter Bubble. Joe Turow, author of the forthcoming The Daily You, How the New Advertising Industry is Defining Your Worth and Your World, from Yale University Press, says we're living in a whole new internet ecosystem
that is looking at us, collecting data, analyzing it, predicting what we do, and then targeting us with ads, discounts, and eventually news and information. And while it's not going to totally take over our lives, it will certainly put us in buckets, I call them reputation silos, as we move forward that may be problematic for society.
Expand on the problematic aspect.
Let's say you have a family with kids, and the kids go online and they talk about what they do, and advertisers figure, God, this kid is heavy. Maybe he likes fast food. So all of a sudden, the son in the family starts getting fast food discounts. The daughter starts getting gym ads that talk about losing weight. The husband begins to be put into buckets that reflect probabilities about income, and all of a sudden sees more used car ads and old car ads. You will get TV commercials and even suggestions about what to watch based upon the buckets that were put in. And we don't even know how we're being described. We don't even know where those data are coming from. And yet they will shape the kinds of things we see in our lives.
Well, I won't say I'm not worried about the effects of personalization. I think in many ways we're still at a very early stage with it.
Jacob Weisberg, editor-in-chief of the Slate Group.
But this is a version, Brooke, of a concern that I've heard since the very beginnings of the internet. My complaint about Eli Pariser's type of thinking is it's totally unempirical.
And you tried to reproduce his results. What happened?
Well, he starts his whole book very elaborately with this anecdote about Google, and he says two friends of his searched for BP, British Petroleum, during the oil spill. And one of them got news about the oil spill, and the other one got investment results about BP. And I said, that just doesn't make sense. I mean, I just don't have any experience of people getting search results that vary that much. So I just set up a very simple experiment. I wouldn't make any claim for it, except that it's a better experiment than he did. And he wrote a whole book about it. And I asked, you know, some people, I use Twitter, and I said, can I have some volunteers, people with different politics, different parts of the country, to just do the same searches? And let's take some terms that are obviously political, Obamacare, and then just the names of, you know, John Boehner, Barney Frank. I had five or six people do this, and they all got essentially the same results. There were only minute differences, and the differences were insignificant.
The insurance consultant from Dubuque got Wikipedia entries for the first two congressmen ahead of the official websites, right, while the others got the official websites first.
Right. And then with Boehner, this was an interesting test. There was a kind of Wikipedia-type site, very hostile to Boehner, and everybody got that in the same place, whether you're right-wing, whether you're left-wing, whether you're in Dubuque, whether you're in New York City. So I just don't believe what he says about Google, and I think that casts into doubt the larger way he raises the issue, not about whether this is something that could happen, but about whether it is happening.
But you yourself list a whole slew of efforts to create personalized news services, whether it's coming from the New York Times or the Washington Post or these personalized magazines for tablets that are based on our Facebook and Twitter feeds. These are all efforts to anticipate what news we are interested in and what news in which we have no interest.
But this is the interesting question. How personalized should personalized news be? Do you just want to get news about sailing and greyhound racing? No, even if you're interested in those subjects, you want them as a supplement, maybe an oversampled supplement, to what actually happened yesterday in the world.
In a rebuke to Pariser in your column, you wrote, "Why assume that when people have more options, they will choose to live in an echo chamber?" I think past behavior allows us to assume that to a large extent. Homophily, the tendency of birds of a feather to flock together, is wired in.
It's never been hard to live in an echo chamber. In fact, I think in many ways it's harder now and was easier before. People didn't used to have a big range of options about information sources. Maybe they had a local newspaper, they had the network news, there were three networks. You could make an argument that most of the country lived in a kind of bubble with a limited range of opinion in the days before the internet brought us this huge variety. But I just try to look at it in terms of my own experience as a starting point and the experience of people I know. On Twitter, you follow people you're interested in, and the people are a proxy for the subjects. So you think someone is good either in your field or another field you care about or some subject that's happening. You start to get this range of sources you've never heard from before. And I find that by using Twitter to personalize the news, I have hugely broadened my range of voices, of ideas. Now, I'm not saying that's absolutely a common experience either. I'm just arguing against the automatic assumption that, oh, because there's some kind of personalization happening, what the personalization is going to do is narrow us.
Once we encounter an information environment like the internet, which is driven by our choices rather than driven by the constraints of a professional editor, I think we have to take very seriously the notion that we might be giving ourselves only what we want to hear.
That's Ethan Zuckerman, senior researcher at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, who suggests that there may be something to fear, not necessarily in our technology, but in ourselves. Our online social circles, the wide collection of loose ties we assemble on Facebook and Twitter, can put us in the path of new ideas, but only if we want them. Pariser says that Facebook stopped sending him news from the conservatives he friended because he didn't interact with them. So is Facebook to blame or Pariser?
The question is agency. Did you choose to do this? Do you have control over it? Or is it happening to you?
Ethan Zuckerman.
I think it's worthwhile to be a careful critic of these algorithms, but I think the personalization that we all do every day by choosing what information we look for, choosing who we talk to and who we interact with, is a much more powerful force in limiting our exposure to different forms of information.
Everybody will say they're going to sign up for this kind of varied diet, just as everybody says their musical tastes are quite varied and unpredictable. And yet, when we look at what they actually do, there's a much narrower range there.
Clay Shirky is a consultant, educator, and author of Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age.
Some of it may be because people's interests are in a narrower range. Some of it may be because people imagine that they have more time to explore the world than they actually do, right? You know, there's a handful of coast-hugging eggheads who have all the time in the world to just experience the media landscape in its full, crazy, and chaotic glory. And we think everybody ought to do like that. But, of course, everybody has a job, and most people's jobs don't involve sitting around playing around with the web to see what it's doing today.
Right now, there are plenty of people at work on the problem of engineering encounters with unexpected information, of engendering what netheads call serendipity. For his part, Shirky visits group aggregation sites like Three Quarks Daily and Crooked Timber, sites with more than one editor.
And that gives me a more varied media diet than essentially using my own filters against the web would do.
But for the reasons he just stated, the group that seeks the ideas of people who think differently from themselves will always be small.
This is, I think, the great weakness in the work being done on these kind of serendipity options, is to assume that everybody somehow deep down wants to be surprised or challenged.
In fact, he says that the new media are exposing us to unwelcome information far more than back when we were limited to cable and the daily paper. The conservative and liberal blogospheres link to each other all the time, and it's degrading public discourse.
Constant exposure to the idea that people disagree with you actually enrages people. So the polarization, I think, doesn't come from us cutting ourselves off from people who disagree with us, but rather from the irritation of constant exposure to the idea that there are people who disagree with us and that they are also out speaking in public, just as we are. I think that the threat of polarization is there, but I think that Sunstein's diagnosis of the reasons it happened were wrong. So in a way, the cure he proposed might make the disease worse.
The cure, meaning greater exposure to other people's
exactly
views.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
That's very dark, Clay.
You know, look, I'm a Madisonian. I don't think that you ever get rid of factionalism. I don't think that what we want is for each individual to become more moderate. I think what we want is for the democratic system to produce the kind of fights that lead to moderate outcomes, even if all of the participants are partisan.
Hmm. 2 years ago, Lee Rainey at Pew's Internet and American Life Project soothed me with data. I think I need to call him again.
More people nowadays say they get political news and information from sources that share their point of view than were telling us that a couple of years ago.
Oh, no.
At the same time, we see among the heaviest internet users, the people who presumably would have the most sophisticated filtering tools and the inclination to go into that echo chamber if they felt like it, those people are getting more information from more sources and a greater diversity of points of view than they have before. So it's a mixed picture.
How many of those latter people are there?
There are fewer of them than there used to be. We definitely know that there are fewer people now on any given day who get any kind of news. About a decade ago, it was about a tenth of the population. Now it's about a fifth of the population who say on any given day, I didn't get news from any source.
Is the internet creating a situation that enables us to be and results in us being more intellectually isolated?
Possibly. Brooke, I had you in mind when I drafted this battery of questions that we ran in the post-election survey we did in 2010, and it shows you what a mixed bag this situation is. So I'm just going to read you a bunch of questions and a bunch of data to show you how confused and fun this world is for us to be studying. Would you say that the internet makes it easier to connect with others who share your political views or had no impact? 54% said, it's easier for me now to find people who share my point of view, and 42% said it didn't make any impact. So then we asked them, which of the following statements comes closest to your point of view? The internet increases the influence of those with extreme political views, or the internet reduces the influence of those with extreme views by giving ordinary citizens a chance to be heard? 55% said it increases the influence of extreme views. 30% said it reduces the influence of extreme views, and the rest said they didn't really know. So again, people are worried about the echo chamber, particularly if it drives up the power of extreme voices. But then we asked people, do you think that the internet exposes people to a wider range of political views than they can get in the traditional news media? 61% said it increases the range of views. So that flies against the notion that an echo chamber is there because the internet is providing a lot more people the opportunity to expose themselves to points of view that they wouldn't get from traditional media. The final question we asked, again, sort of our Brooke battery here. Thinking about the political information you find online, would you say it's usually easy or difficult for you to tell what is true from what is not true? 56 said it is difficult. 33% said it's easy. So this is just a more challenging information environment that, yes, is pushing more people towards people who are like them or towards points of view that are similar to theirs, and yet they can celebrate the fact that they are aware of more things, or they think their fellow citizens are aware of more things because the internet just has allowed this proliferation of voices and niches to come into being.
Do you feel less sanguine about this echo chamber business now than you did, say, 5 years ago?
Yeah, there are more structures in place that potentially push people into echo chambers, but I don't think we fully understand yet the pathways of information in order to be able to say definitively, this is happening, it's bad, or this is happening in certain ways that aren't necessarily so bad. So it's a pretty mixed picture, and we haven't yet reached the end of the road with it.
I'm counting on you, Lee.
Brooke, there are so many more Brooke batteries for us to ask that I have confidence that we'll keep talking about this as long as your show is on and I keep getting funding.
Lee Rainey, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Ultimately, as Ethan Zuckerman observed, it comes down to choice. We choose echo chambers. In fact, we're wired to. But with conscious effort regularly applied, we can defeat that impulse by adding new circuits and connections to the standard array. The new technology makes it so easy and so hard.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Asia Bandawi, with more help from Joe Rosenberg and Emily Chin, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.